Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. My name is Anthony. This week, Martin's co-author Linda Antonsen is back to cover Ned's 10th POV chapter. And then Linda and I talk a little bit about representation in Hollywood. As you might have guessed, Linda and I take different views on this. So the second half of my interview with Linda is specifically devoted to that conversation. I hope you receive this as an example of a respectful but robust disagreement. Steve and I do a double-length review of The Children, that's the season finale, with farewells to Tywin and maybe the Hound? Without further ado, here is Linda Antonsen. Linda Antonsen, welcome back to Electric Boogaloo. Today we're covering Ned 10.
Thank you very much for having me on again, and it's definitely a pleasure to be talking about this particular chapter, because it is one of my favorites in the whole series.
Yeah, I was expecting it to be much longer, because it's so action-packed.
It is, and it's not just the plot element, but I feel that it also serves as something of a turning point in a Game of Thrones, and something that really further hits home the idea of what kind of world this is. And I feel like it has a lot to do, this chapter, with sort of the death of chivalry.
Oh, interesting. That's great. I just recently had a conversation about this this idea of chivalry, in the sense that, I guess the question of that other conversation I was having is, how much does Martin want to critique the entire notion of chivalry? And I mean, there are many characters who do serve as that kind of critique, but there are many characters like Ned who seem to feel like chivalry is all, I shouldn't say all important, but it was quite important.
For Ned, I would say honor is, he doesn't necessarily hold with some of the pageantry around chivalry, but certainly the honor part of chivalry, and being, I mean, he's obviously not a knight himself, but holding true to the ideals. So Ned and someone like Brienne, they very much, funnily enough, neither of them are knights, but they are the ones that sort of believe in this. And and of course, the Kingsguard, that, you know, used to be this shining example to the realm, and this is the death of the last vestige of that. Other than, obviously, you have Barristan, but he has, in the eyes of the other three Kingsguard in this chapter, done something wrong in bending the knee and pledging to the new king.
Right. And then in sort of the present day circumstances of the book, you know, you've got the young upstart Jaime Lannister, who clearly has different views on what it would mean to be a Kingsguard, I suppose. And Barristan is really, he's presented as someone that Ned views as honorable.
Yeah, but he's, other than that, he, the Kingsguard of Robert, there's a rot at the core of it. And of course, we see that with Robert's behavior in this chapter as well, that the crown has been very heavy on his brow. It doesn't sit well with him.
It doesn't suit him.
He never really wanted the crown. He wanted Lyanna, and he wanted to avenge the wrongs done his friends and his family.
Right.
And then he ended up with the crown, a queen that he's not particularly keen on either.
Yeah. And it's, he says something really interesting in this chapter. He says that Rhaegar won because, he says, Rhaegar won, he's with Lyanna.
Yeah.
And here I am, even though I might have won the battle and won the throne, here I am stuck with Cersei. And this is a major loss.
And I mean, he says it himself, you know, like hitting her, it's not kingly. And
he says something that's really quite ignorant. He says, how do you fight someone without actually, you know, without actually being
hitting
able
them.
To hit them,
yeah.
Right? You know, his notion of being able to...
He solves problems with a hammer.
Yes, he is a hammer. I mean, that's who he is.
Yes.
And of course, Cersei, if it was just about exchanging barbs, she's going to win every time. And so then Robert, you know, he feels like, oh, it's not kingly to do so. But look, she made me do it, which I think is a sort of a ridiculous statement.
Well, it is, but she has hit him herself. She threw a goblet at him at one point and chipped one of his teeth, for example.
Right.
So
they
are horrible for
They
each
are
other.
Horrible for each other, and they bring out the worst in each other.
They
at the same
out,
time,
yeah.
What an ignorant statement to say. You know, how do you fight someone without actually punching them? It's just a silly point of view.
No, when all you have is a hammer, everything starts looking like a nail.
Yes, that's right. Let me read the synopsis I wrote. So, Ned is dreaming. In his dream, he recalls arriving at a stone tower in Dorne, guarded by 3 Targaryen loyalists. In his dream, he is flanked by 6 companions. The 2 parties exchange words about recent events at the Trident, Dragonstone, and King's Landing. But the reason for this encounter is in the Stone Tower. In his dream, Lyanna seems to be calling for Ned. Courtesies are exhausted, and Sir Arthur Dayne unsheathes his great sword, and the 2 parties clash. Ned wakes to find himself in a bed, having slept for 6 days. After an update from Alyn, Robert and Cersei enter. They question Ned about Kat's actions and Ned's encounter with Jaime. Robert and Cersei exchange barbs, and then the king strikes her in the face, sending her stumbling across the room. Once she has left, Robert demands that Ned reassume his duties as Hand of the King. So, Linda Antonsen, would you like to talk about a character, a theme, a plot point, or shall you and I climb the ladder of chaos?
I think we already started climbing a little bit here. I mean, we touched upon the chivalry aspect and the importance here of the of these Kingsguard and the structure. What I particularly love about the start of this chapter is the way his dream recollection is structured something like a fairy tale.
Right? Oh,
it's got these, you know, I looked for you on the Trident. We were not there. When King's Landing fell, Sir Jaime slew your king with a golden sword, and I wondered where you were. Our knees do not bend easily. So he's got these answers and these questions
sure.
and exchanges 3 times. You know, you've got that number 3, which often is significant. And I mean, you've got the 3 Kingsguard. So I really like that exchange.
It does feel like, you know, this is who knows how much of this is Ned's distortion of the memory and the dream's distortion of the memory. Mm. But it does really have that sense of that it's, you know.
It's a very different style. It's a very much more poetic writing than you see in Martin's prose for the most part. This one stands out, and also with the exchange at the end with the "and now it begins, no, now it ends," and the sadness. I mean, all of this is always tied up with such sadness for
right.
Ned.
Sure,
it's. On the sad smile on Arthur Dayne's lips. So there's such tragedy resting over the whole thing. And then, of course, we get these little hints, which some people were put them together from A Game of
right.
Thrones, The Bed of Blood.
That's in the very first line.
Yes.
It actually says, he dreamt an old dream of 3 knights in white cloaks, and a tower long fallen, and Lyanna in her bed of blood. You know, which could easily mean, you know, that Lyanna has been slain or something like that, right?
Right. At this point, but I think that there were some people who twigged to it fairly early on that this could, was a phrase you could use to talk about childbed. The dangers of childbed, and that's when people started wondering what exactly had happened at the Tower of Joy and why where these three Kingsguard left to guard it when Rhaegar definitely could have used them on the
Yeah.
Trident.
It is significant, and I was just talking with a medievalist named Ken Monshain, and he was saying in these ancient battles, you might have 1,000 men behind you, but most of those men are not professional warriors, and they probably don't have weapons or horses or whatever. To have a knight among that group, it's like having an additional 10 men. So if you are leaving 3 knights out of the battle,
Three of your
it's
very best knights.
yes, 3 of your best, very best knights, right? So that is quite a significant choice, and might have cost Rhaegar the Trident. I mean, we couldn't say,
No.
but yes, absolutely, it's a
I mean, he
significant
had
choice.
his Kingsguard, and while it is entirely possible that Rhaegar still would have responded to Robert's challenge on to meet him one on one rather than sort of have the shield of his Kingsguard among him, the Kingsguard would certainly have made an effort to perhaps reach Robert ahead of Rhaegar and dispatch him. And someone like Arthur Dayne with Dawn would have been an incredibly difficult opponent even for Robert. Given the properties of that sword.
So you say some people were keen enough to point out that, Lyanna could have just given birth.
I mean, we have a few references in A Game of Thrones that you could start piecing together. There's the rose petals, for example, and then people started wondering, does this represent the rose petals of the crown of blue roses that Rhaegar gave Lyanna? At Harrenhal at the tourney.
Oh, interesting.
And
Yeah, I missed that.
if she has kept this with her as an important symbol, well, that starts making the whole, rape and abduction story sound very fishy.
Yeah, it says a storm of rose petals blew across a blood-streaked sky as blue as the eyes of death. And I was going to call that out and ask you what you thought about that line.
Oh, well, of course, the eyes, blue as death, as blue as the eyes of death, that makes you think of the others. And this ties nicely to the vision that Bran has of the blue flower growing out of a chink in the wall. I mean, there's a blue rose. So that's where people have then pieced that together with John, for example, then that the idea that, okay, he's on the wall. He's certainly connected to the others and everything,
Right. Yeah.
and this blue rose that has come to symbolize, Rhaegar and Lyanna, and particularly Lyanna, of course, is flourishing on the wall. So those two together
Sure.
is that little trail of clues. So I just love the way he built
Right.
up this. Especially early on, when you got these little clues and these conflicting bits of information about what really happened, and you start realizing more and more that Robert's view of Rhaegar personally is extremely colored by his personal hatred.
Yes, and Robert has he says things that either cannot be true or he could not know, like how many times Rhaegar raped Lyanna. He's got this thing in his mind. He's created this fiction for himself. If you look at the things Robert says, even in this chapter, that now Rhaegar is with Lyanna. He got Lyanna. They're together. I mean, he's created this entire fiction for himself to make himself, I don't know, a tragic figure.
He's extremely unhinged on the topic of Rhaegar and Lyanna.
Yeah.
It, as I said, it doesn't really, it is a complete fiction. He was, and I mean, we know that, Lyanna herself told Ned that she didn't really think that love was going to change Robert.
Yeah, that's right.
She had an understanding of what he was like, but he became obsessed with her. And if they had married, I'm sure it wouldn't have gone as, badly as with Cersei, because Lyanna may have been, wild and stubborn, but probably not so inclined to spitefulness as Cersei. But they would have had fights.
Yeah, it's really hard to know what would have happened. I mean, Lyanna's view on Robert is that, a man is a man and you're not going to change his nature. And she's probably right, but there's really no way to know, because I do think that either Robert is in love with the idea of her or he's growing in love for her. He certainly would have began that union differently than with
Oh,
Cersei, I think.
absolutely. He would have hoped, I think he would have tried very hard to be a good husband. I imagine he would not have been drinking so much. He would have not.
Sure, and he wouldn't have had a wife whose bed is reserved only for her brother. I mean,
No, that does things to improve your marriage when that's not the case, certainly.
Right.
But would he still have visited whorehouses?
Yes, maybe. I mean, I the probably he would. And then the question is, how does the marriage survive that?
Miliana seemed prepared for it,
Yeah,
but even
absolutely.
so, Ned talked about how she and Brandon were the two wild wolves.
Sure.
Would she have welcomed him home with a dagger in her hand when he came crawling back late some night and
Well, whatever the case, you can see why Lyanna is not nearly as infatuated with Robert as he is. I feel like whatever else is the possibility, she has fallen for Rhaegar. And as we learn over and over and over in this story arc, when you pursue a union on the basis of love, it does not end well. That is not the world that this is creating. If you pursue, like, if you are like Rob and you pursue, the wife that you love rather than the wife for political arrangement, those things never end well. I
No.
can't think of one example of a marriage that began, motivated by love in the story that ends well.
Yeah, they're quite far between, I would say. If we look historically in the setting, the marriage of Daenerys and Alysanne worked out pretty well for King Daenerys, the old king.
Oh yeah, maybe. Yeah,
But even
okay.
they had
Yeah.
periods, they had two separations over disagreements.
Sure.
And
No, but that would be a great counterexample. I was thinking of Tyrion's marriage to Tysha,
yeah,
which of course is doomed from the
doomed
start.
from the start, Jorah Mormont wooing and winning Lyanna Hightower and thinking. He thinking it was, love and an infatuation from her as well.
Even Lysa, who seems, to be in love with Littlefinger, this doesn't work out well for her.
No, of course it's a very one-sided
Yeah, of course.
in that situation.
Yeah.
She doesn't quite realize that she's the wrong sister there.
Well, and then you could look at, Baelish wanting to couple with Kat, and of course that doesn't work out well for Baelish. So.
No, love tends to backfire. It's not a setting that is kind to romantics.
Well, and because we're so focused in this story on social elites and political elites, the marriage and the marriage bed and the progeny from the marriage bed, these are all very, very political decisions. These all have very important political ramifications. They can bring alliances and then they can end, they can end friendships.
I think we see that with if we look at Cersei's side here and the sort of the look at their marriage as well from her point of view. I mean, she enters into the marriage on false pretenses to start with. She has no intention of giving up sleeping with Jaime, but she wants to be the queen.
Right.
And then, besides, you have to say fairly unfairly on the wedding night, because she wasn't planning to stop sleeping with Jamie, but when Robert gets drunk and says the wrong name, she is like,
Right.
that's it. Access closed for you. Not
Yes,
interested.
exactly.
You screwed up.
Yeah.
So it's not like she can accept that, okay, we both prefer someone else, but you know, we happen to be the king and the queen and we'll have some legitimate heirs. And she immediately goes into full-on vengeance mode for that, and you know, starts the very much the downfall for Robert. I think Robert was somebody who was dependent on people liking him. You know, he was a very gregarious social person who liked good food, good friends, and then he's stuck with somebody who hates him.
I don't know, and maybe you could answer this for me. I don't know whether Robert has just repeated the lie to himself so often so that now he believes it. Or maybe he once had an inkling that Lyanna was not captured, that Lyanna went willingly with Rhaegar, and he just could not accept that fact.
Yeah, I think he must have had some little inkling about it and just immediately buried it. And then, yes, since then he has repeated the story and he gets fiercer and fiercer about it all the time. But perhaps the reason that he gets so ferocious about telling that version of the story is because somewhere buried at the back of his mind is that doubt. Because it's so infected, so poisonous.
He's become this grievance monster, I suppose. He's so driven by this one event in his life that's built on nothing. It's built on vapor. But it's become core to his identity. And it makes him such a. He wants Ned to pity him. He wants Ned to continue to grieve his
Indulge him
grief.
in it, and
Yes,
I mean,
that's
he's
right.
wallowing in it because at some point, I mean, he didn't real if he ever realized it was too late to pull himself out of it. You get little glimmers of it, like here, like where he starts kind of looking and like what happened to me. Like he occasionally has this moment where he wakes up, what happened to me? How can I be like this? I used to be young, strong, healthy, happy, and it just snowballed from the death of Lyanna, the rage that consumed him. And I mean, we see that really revenge. I mean, that's another thing that we see repeated in the story as well, that revenge doesn't end well. He had
Yeah,
his
that's right.
vengeance on Rhaegar. Did it taste well? Did it fix things for him? No.
No, and he even tells Ned, I think in a very early chapter, he tells Ned, I kill him every night in my dreams. Like he can never kill him enough to quench that thirst for revenge. And so now he's just it's consumed him. That's all he
Yeah, and
is.
because he has allowed it to consume him, it's the only thing that he feels anything for any longer.
I thought that the trio of Ned, Cersei, and Robert in that room was an interesting trio, because I think that they're all lying on some level. So Ned repeats the lie that he gave the order for Catelyn to take Tyrion, right? And whatever sort of good intention he has, that's the lie he has told and he's going to stick with. And then Cersei lies in saying that it was actually a drunken Ned who stumbled out of a brothel who attacks Jamie on in the middle of the street. It's just a it's an absurd
I was
lie,
just
right?
thinking about that when I was rereading. I'm like, okay, Cersei, you know, you think you're smart, and you have
Yeah, it's a lie that doesn't have any plausibility at all.
to claim that Ned stumbled drunk out of a brothel.
And of course, Robert continues to repeat that lie to himself about Lyanna. And he always with Ned, he's always goes back to that refrain, and Ned never corrects him. I think he knows
There's no point.
that yeah, there's no point, or I don't know, but it just seems like if he was truly Robert's friend, at some point, I think that you would want to, this guy's lived with this pitiable deception, self-deception for 14 years. At some point, if you're a friend, don't you say something? Maybe Robert's not the kind of guy who can listen to that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, we see his sore points here. You know, Cersei brings up the, you know, if any man had dared to speak to a Targaryen as he spoke to you, and it's like, if you take me for ears, you can just see how he immediately gets furious. I mean, when his face is dark with anger, and then she pushes the other button, you know, you ought to be in skirts and me in mail, and he knows that he's not as, you know, fit and strong and like he used to be. So that's a dangerous one too.
She knows that any sort of challenge to his masculinity it's just gonna set him off. Some notable introductions in this chapter. Well, gosh, we meet Martin Castle, Thea Wool, Ethan Glover, Mark Riswell, Howland Reed, and Lord Dunstan. And this is sort of Ned's flank, you know, when he's dreaming.
They meet and say goodbye to them in short order, other than Howland Reed.
That's right. And then, of course, they stand against Arthur Dayne, who we've heard before. But we, in his dream, we get to meet his greatsword, Dawn. And then Oswell Went and Gerald Hightower. But that group of the Kingsguard, this is, you know, you do get the sense that it's not quite even, but man, you're going to need all seven of those fighters to overtake these three Kingsguard.
And of course, later we learn that Ned only survived because of Howland Reed.
That's right. Now, this brings me to a show difference. All right, so the way that this is brought into the show is not through Ned's dream, but through Bran's green scene.
Right.
And when Bran sees this, you know, he's been told this story about how his father defeated Sir Arthur Dayne. You know, the way that it's presented in the show is that actually Arthur Dayne had the better of Ned, and then Howland Reed stabs him in the back. But the other crucial difference is it's not seven against three, it's six against two. And for whatever reason, Sir Arthur Dayne doesn't have his greatsword. He's not fighting with two hands on a greatsword. He's fighting with two swords, and one in both hand. And I think that maybe that just looks better for the choreography of the show. But I was a little disappointed.
I was a little disappointed that
I didn't get to see Dawn in action, you know?
Everyone who had read the books was very disappointed not to see this in the first season. really looking forward to seeing it there as a dream sequence. This kind of fell under the whole, we don't want to give away too much too early. So they pushed it later.
Right. Linda, I was hoping that we could talk a little bit about ethnic representation in the HBO adaptations, because I think that you and I have differing opinions on this. And I thought it would be valuable to hash those out in a professional and respectful way.
Absolutely.
For the most part, I come to these books and to these shows for entertainment. You know, I have fun with them. It's a nice little excursion from my other concerns. It's fantasy, and it provides what fantasy provides. It's something of an escape. That said, I do think that there are certain ethical decisions that are attached to casting, as there are ethical decisions attached to almost everything in the real world. So I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about, you know, your experiencing the narrative dually versus the books and the shows. And then I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about your preferences for casting.
Yeah. I mean, as a baseline, I'd have to say, you know, I'm very much a purist. That's apparently a very dangerous thing to say on Twitter, because last time I used that argument, I was told, well, so was Hitler, and that was the end of that polite conversation. I obviously did not mean a purist in that way. But if you look at the castings of Game of Thrones, there were really only two castings that I had, thumbs up on. I thought that Harry Lloyd was fantastic as Viserys and Conleth Hill as Varys. The rest I had a list of complaints about.
Sure.
I you know I like
So if you
Jamie's
had been casting, it would have been an entirely different cast.
it would have been an entirely different cast. I complained about Jamie's hair color, especially after the first season, where they decided they didn't need to bother with a blonde wig any longer, and it just went progressively more brown. And like Lysa, she is described as fat in the books. Why is she not allowed to be fat? Which is also a representation issue. And Martin has put this character in, and yes, she's not a nice character, but can you only cast people who you perceive as somehow marginalized in nice roles? And that is a whole other can of worms, really. So,
I feel like, all right, so I was just talking about the difference between the hair color of Theon and Rob. So it's actually quite important for their characterization that Rob has this auburn hair in the books, which looks to Kat's eyes and to Ned's eyes, he looks like he favors the Tullys. It's an important detail because, of course, it makes someone like Jon Snow look all the more Starkish, right? And this is going to be a problem for Kat, right? So Theon has black hair, and in the show, it's reversed. All of a sudden, you have Theon with auburn-ish hair and Robb Stark with black hair, and I never cared when I watched. Because those actors to me were so crucial to my experience of that narrative that I almost at this point can't imagine another actor in that role. And their hair color, just it's such a superficial thing in retrospect. So I guess the actors won me over, I suppose I should say.
Yeah, I would say that I'm a little bit more towards the whole that you should try and be as faithful as you possibly can be. Like, I know George actually expressed something similar on a live journal, not about Game of Thrones, because he doesn't really comment on the adaptation of his own works, but other adaptations like superhero adaptations and so on. He doesn't like when somebody adapting something tries to, second guess the author or anything like that, and make improvement and such. And there are obviously changes that you have to do for practical reasons. And yes, I do realize that you can't match up like perfectly hair colors and heights and what have you. Sometimes you cast, just whoever feels like they're inhabiting the character best.
Yeah, that's how I feel.
Then there's the whole world building side of me that, like, it's a huge thing for me, and then I get really upset about those things. So I
Well,
certainly feel
I think Tyrion famously, he had this platinum hair in the beginning. And then, of course, you go through screen tests or whatever, and you decide, do we want to continue to distract people with something that clearly looks like a wig or something? It just doesn't look right. The other, I guess, the first time I actually encountered this was with the movie Shawshank Redemption. Are you familiar with it's a sort of a classic.
I have seen it at some point, but I wouldn't say that I'm super familiar with it, but
So it's a Stephen King story, and the role of Red in that show is played by this Irish redhead, or in the book, in the short story or whatever, it's played by this Irish redhead, and of course, famously in the movie, it's played by Morgan Freeman, who's not an Irish
fooled
redhead.
me.
But I absolutely cannot imagine that movie without Morgan Freeman. He was so integral to that movie that I just think, I'm so glad that they chose the best actor for that role. Because in this way, the best actor for the role didn't have red hair, and it didn't matter. It absolutely didn't matter to me.
I think it may fall a little bit on also where, as in, I'd say that I'm much more of a reader than a TV and movie watcher, that I vastly more enjoy and get engaged with books than with TV shows. So it's very hard for a TV show to have that impact on me, where I absolutely say, oh, well, this has completely changed how I view things. Like when I reread Song of Ice and Fire now, there's only one thing I have with me from Game of Thrones that has in any way affected my reading experience. I don't see any of the actors. But
right, interesting.
But I hear Conleth Hill's voice for Varys. That is actually the only thing that has stuck with me as in my imagination. So I gravitate towards text over visuals.
Interesting. Well, and you had a much longer relationship with these books than most folks, most show watchers anyway. Most show watchers experience it on the screen.
Yeah.
And of course, or even with me, like just reading in parallel.
Right.
So I read most of the books before start of the second season. But even so, I was I had a parallel experience.
Yeah. It does make a big difference.
It's a big difference for sure.
Yeah.
I think the other difference that we should probably call out is that I'm an American. And so my relationship to racial constructs is going to be colored by my relationship to American history.
Yeah. No.
And so for me, when I see casting decisions critiqued on the basis of race, I immediately think, oh no, but this is an ethical decision. Americans need to make ethical decisions, especially in these ways. But I'm imagining that, you know, you don't have that same relationship to American history, for example.
No, I mean, obviously it's impossible to have the same when you haven't grown up there. And while I would say that there is a pressure for the, what I would sort of say, you know, identity politics in Sweden as well, it feels very much imposed on by and borrowed from the US, because you often see it put forward in such a way in Sweden where you realize that it doesn't really fit the experience here.
So is it a little, is it in a sense, these identity politics is a little bit of sort of ideological imperialism? Like, this is not something that Swedish folk would naturally care about, but we feel like we need to care about it because, you know, American media dominates, something like that.
I would argue that it is that. It has very much been embraced by, you know, if we talk politically about by the left in particular, and whereas I would call myself very much fiscally and socially left, I've found it's very difficult to see how that meshes with our actual, you know, history. And there's been these odd cases of trying to, well, we need to care as much about, representation of, for example, Black people in Sweden as they do in the US. And because we also have a history of, we had, you know, for a few years, an attempt at one colony for slave trade in America, which I think pretty much went nowhere, and there was never any slavery in Sweden or anything like that. And it gets so odd when people try and somehow bring those things up and try and equal, somehow say that it has as much of an impact on Swedish history. It's obviously something one should be aware of and not, you know, ignore.
And at the same time, I suppose that it's just the way of things that Swedish media and Swedish media consumers are going to have to stand in some relationship with American politics.
Unavoidable, absolutely.
It's unavoidable, yeah. Right?
And I think that, well, if I look at my own sort of reactions to this and relationship to it, I do have an issue with, like, I'd say it's a hierarchy of issues where one starts at, I don't actually ultimately believe in the idea that you should be changing things for, like, the sort of ethical reasons, because I, you know, the climate that I have grown up in and so on, for me, it's very hard to see that as a necessity. I understand the reasoning and so on, but I guess I feel it's important for representation. But I guess I feel like, for example, why in this particular show was it necessary here, or is it really an altruistic decision? Because surely, I mean, the bottom line for most of these decisions comes down to that HBO does not want to get called out for it.
Yeah, I kind of feel like, I mean, there's two things happening, yeah. I suppose. I feel like, of course, I'm not expecting an HBO executive to do the right thing for the right reason. So it's enough for me for that person to do the right thing. And I don't care if they're feeling pressured or whatever. I really don't care what their motives are. I want them to do the right thing. But then I guess the other question is it really the right thing? And I wanted to ask you, did you ever, or were you ever a fan of the original Star Trek series?
I came to it late, but Yes.
So I was a kid and I used to watch it with my father. And my experience, I just enjoyed it. You know, they were sort of pushing borders on Captain Kirk, you know, kissing Uhura or something like that. And to me, it never crossed my mind that this was something that was scandalous.
Yeah.
I was a kid growing up in the late 70s, early 80s in Northern California. This is not, there's no scandal here at all. And then later, hearing other people talk about their experience, like, for instance, Whoopi Goldberg has said, when I saw Uhura on the television screen, it changed my life. Her lived experience was so much different than mine that it actually was crucially important to her that Uhura was represented on the screen in a time when that representation just didn't exist. And so in retrospect, I thought, oh, for her, it was crucially important. And to me, it didn't matter at all.
Mm.
And the reason why it didn't matter to me at all, because of who I am and my experience of the lived world and where I grew up. But I want to be able to affirm someone else's experience that says, no, Uhura was crucial to me. You know, it wasn't inconsequential that she was a black woman on television.
Absolutely, that it, you know, it can make an enormous difference to see having, you know, gay characters and women in roles as well that they haven't had. That will obviously be, you know, television can be extremely important that way in showing things that you couldn't imagine before. So there is certainly an importance to it. But I guess what one feels today, which makes me, you know, be a bit like a stubborn horse and kick at people, basically, is that everything seems to be about, there is this huge fear, this culture where, this seems to be very particularly American, there's some sort of self-flagellation going on about past mistakes.
You know, I used to feel that way too, and I think it's because I grew up where I grew up. And then I moved to Dayton, Ohio, which is a very segregated city still. Not by force, but just people's prejudice.
Mm.
And now that I'm in Dayton, I realize, oh, this isn't sort of lip service and, you know, superfluous sensitivity stuff. This is just a continued reality of racial discrimination in America. And my feeling is that There's just not enough that's being done.
I can totally tell.
I mean, look, I there's no way I could even imagine what it's like to experience American culture from the outside. I mean, I've lived in Canada and I've lived in Africa and I've lived in England, and I have friends in those parts of the world. And so I can kind of see what America looks like with all of our faults, with all of our many, many faults from an outsider point of view. But I can never live that point of view. By the same token, I think it's probably impossible for me to actually, you know, live in the skin of an, of someone who's been historically discriminated against.
No, absolutely. Certainly, I, you know, Sweden, you know, when I grew up, it's less so now, was of course incredibly white. So, you know, if I had written a fantasy novel where I, you know, largely thought of my own experiences, it would certainly have been very white. It's, you know, that's just the nature of it, that you're very affected by your surroundings. And I mean, it's a difficult, I mean, there is an absolutely an important aspect to it. But then if one looks at sort of the discussion that comes up around it, when you talk about these adaptation changes and so on, there are unfortunately people who are very disingenuous about it and make it very, and I guess certainly makes me more opposed to serving, you know, something that they feel is a good idea, because they are being so peculiar about how they argue things. For example, there will always be people, whenever, with a change on Game of Thrones, for example, where Salladhor Saan was cast as a black actor, and also in Karth.
Zaxxas.
Zaxxas, yeah. People will say that, oh, well, you know, they would say that, I always thought this character was black. I was like,
yeah,
okay, pay something. And that's just so disrespectful to the text. Like, no, really, you can't pretend that. But people would be use these bullshit arguments to, instead of just saying, yeah, this is a major change, you know, it really doesn't mesh with the world building. And it is done for, you know, if you want to call them ethical or political reasons, that is the reasoning for it. It really doesn't have any basis in the text, but we are okay with it. With that honesty, I would say, you know, fine, they can cast the show however they like. I don't like it, and I don't necessarily agree with the reasons for it, but it is what it is. But you get people trying to justify the changes by saying, well, it doesn't actually explicitly describe the skin color in the text. Well, no, but describe the skin color of all the family of the person, for example. And you're saying that this person is from, you know.
Yeah, but I guess I wonder why it's such a major. I mean, to me, it doesn't feel like. I'm on record as saying I love Salladhor Saan as he's such a fun addition to the show, because he's, to me, that actor brings such a sort of zest for life. I just want to follow that guy around everywhere and just see what he's doing. I just I think he's the only one that's having fun in Westeros. So I mean, I love that guy so much. And then I think, well, then why is it actually a major change? Are we putting too much emphasis on world building over and against the, to me, the all important fact of the actor's ability? That's my question.
Yeah. Well, I think here again, we're falling on the whole side of, I'm on the side of the text sort of more than, you know, obviously I want the adaptation to be well acted, but I think so many people don't understand how utterly crucial world building is to fantasy. How the fact that you have to sell this world to people and make it feel like a reality, because otherwise people, you won't care about the people, right? It's less important on a TV show. I think you can get away with more hand waving, although we saw that towards the final seasons that hand waving was biting them. So I've had people, and I've seen multiple times people saying that somebody's complaining about them casting a black actor in Game of Thrones or House of the Dragon, but it's a show with dragons. It can have whatever. And that, just that argument makes me furious, I have to say.
Let's agree that world building is actually crucial. So let's start there. We both agree on this point. Because it is so crucial, because world building is so important, to me, the ethical elements of casting become important. And I mean, look, if this show was cast in the mid-90s, it could have been all white and it would have gotten very little resistance because that was just a different world, you know, back when Martin was writing these books.
Yeah.
That's certainly not the world we're living in now. No. And I think that we know better. I think that hopefully we've learned that to only ever show white people on the screen, that this is, it's actually a ridiculous decision to make. And then, of course, then the question is, does it take you out of the experience of the world? Are you now living, you know, in a different time and place? For you, I think it does take you out of it.
It does.
In a way that maybe it doesn't affect,
no.
I don't know.
No, because, you know, whenever I saw Salah Lusson, I was like, Jesus, the guy is Lusseni. They breed for the Valyrian look. It's like, it is the last place where you'd have somebody from an old family. I mean, there, with him like being a standalone character, he could have been adopted into a family. For example, you could find explanations.
Yeah. What I hear you saying is, okay, make the change, but be honest about why you're making the change.
Yeah, I think be
honest. Tell us that you've made this change for political reasons or ethical reasons or whatever you want to say. And tell us that you're not being faithful to the text and that it's disingenuous to just try to make up a reason for this.
Or, I mean, if you make up, they did with Zarozo and Daxos. They said, because, you know, it's kind of odd that the two decisions they made for significant black actors in the beginning of Game of Thrones was Alyseni, famously known to be, you know, pale and golden haired, and a Carthian merchant, famously known as the Milkman. There were other characters they could have chosen, I think, with equal...
Like Ben Plum or something like that, right?
Yes, and why did they have Ross instead of Shataya and Alayaya? So they took out some characters and put in others. But with Zarozo and Daxos, they had some idea about how he was a foreigner who moved into Carth and made his wealth, which turned out to be no wealth at all, because he scammed them all. And fine, if you can make a backstory that works. Yeah, I can buy that. And if we look then at House of the Dragon now, they've made a very... Here, you'd have to say they've made an enormously significant change by making Corlys Velaryon black. And if one, you know, looks at various spy photos and so on, it seems like just about everyone in the Velaryon circle is black. And
well, I think that to me, it feels like you're always going to make a change. It's always going to be the case. It's always going to be, it's very rare that the right actor is going to look exactly how they look in the book. And so then the question is, then what's too far? Is the skin color too far? Is the hair color too far? Is the fact that that Emile Clarke has dark eyebrows and platinum blonde hair, is that too too far for my wife? My wife is like, why don't her eyebrows match her hair? You know, that's the kind of thing. So then the question is, all right, if almost none of these actors perfectly represent the characters in the books, then why are we excluding black actors?
I mean, I guess with the Valyrians and their connection here to the Targaryens, it's the fact that we have such a strong overall description of what Valyrians are supposed to look like, and the fact that they were a very homogenous population. So because they didn't decide to break with what they had already done on Game of Thrones, I mean, they could have cast all the Targaryens as black as well. Because obviously, famously, George said, I even considered making the Valyrians black. But I had...
Well, because they're so much modeled after the mythology of Egypt. I mean, that to me, that would have been an interesting decision.
The Egypt, Rome, there's... but yes, so he seriously considered it. He opted against it for two reasons, or one was that he wasn't sure that the idea of a foreign conqueror and basically the mad bad guys of the series should be black. So he made a decision that was for, to some extent, political reasons there. And he also said he really wanted, because they were his kind of elves, he seemed quite taken with the idea of the silver hair. He really wanted to keep that. And then he said, but then I'm gonna stray into drow territory if I have these black skinned characters with white hair or silver hair. And that's too strong in the fantasy sphere, the dark elf look. I don't want to go there because they are also associated with evil.
Yeah, and I guess the question is, why are they associated with evil? I mean, I think that there's racism that is on the surface that has to do with the emotionality of the person and habits, but there's also structural racism that often people don't see in themselves. And I'm of the mind that, yeah, we're probably all a little bit racist, in that, whether or not it's sort of an admission that we're making or not. So, I mean, look. Why are dark elves evil? There's probably a little bit of racism there.
Well, I would agree with you completely that by nature humans are racist because we grav as in to some degree because we gravitate to our group ever since we were, little tribal groups. It was we are the people, the others outside of our group, the ones that don't look like us, the don't ones that don't dress like us, they're somebody else. That's the tribal mentality that we have to live with. I think that we're never going to erase the fact that different, we can acknowledge it and be aware of it.
Yeah, but one way to expand people's imaginations is by good storytelling. And I feel like as long as a show like Game of Thrones or House of the Dragon tells the story well, I will certainly forget that Corlys should have been white at one point. I mean, to me, that feels like if you're telling a good story and the actor is inhabiting the role, then it actually is quite a powerful and ethical decision to portray someone that's maybe outside of your little tribe as someone who can engender empathy.
True. Of course, some of us are going to be sitting there and thinking, okay, Corlys looks like he is, he doesn't look mixed race. Two generations back, they provided a queen for the Targaryens, and they are all looking lily white.
Yeah, I guess I
I
just
can't suspend, to me, I can't suspend that
I get it.
disbelief.
I get that you can that's always going to be sort of in the back of your mind. And for me, I think that I can easily forget those sorts of things.
No, but it's just the difference in how one sees adaptations, and I say that I'm much pickier when you're talking about something that's likely to be adapted once. If you're talking about like a Shakespeare play, you can have a dog play Richard the Third. It's like
Well,
the
then why
dog
is that?
version.
Tell me why. I mean, if I'm watching, let's say I'm watching the Disney Robin Hood, and Robin Hood is played by a fox, I'm in.
No,
Yeah, that's
that was my
fine.
first
Just
exposure to
make.
Robin Hood, and I've always thought that some of the sheriffs later on look an awful lot like that lion. There are some actors, so that clearly colored my
So
view.
I'm happy with that. I can do it if you tell the story well enough. I am happy for Robin Hood to be a fox, and
But when you live with a text and then you it's going to be the one and only shot at seeing this, you have this, at least I have this very strong desire to see what's in my head, or
I
something as
get it.
close as possible to what's in my head. And
Yeah, I
then
get it. And then I would say, yeah, but there are other people watching. It's not all about what's in Linda's head.
no,
And
there isn't.
the other people watching, they have a different lived experience, and some of
But
these
if they
things
had a
are.
black Corlys in their head, then they need new glasses.
No, I never had a black Corlys in my head, but when I saw the actor, they put out an image of like, the costume or whatever. I was like, cool. I'm glad they made this decision. I think that there ought to be more black protagonists in Game of Thrones, and I'm happy to see how this one, you know, I'm happy to see how this iteration of the story presents itself.
Yeah.
And that's just the way that I approach it. Let's take a look at Tolkien. So for instance, people have hit Tolkien for the way that he represents skin color in that story. And it's very often forgotten that several of the hobbits are supposed to have a darker skin color.
Yeah.
Like, so for Sam, as a Harfoot, should have a darker brown skin color. Yeah. But of course, the way that the hobbits are always represented on the screen has been white.
Yeah.
So if that's the decision that Hollywood has made for generations, casting white characters in Egyptian roles, casting white characters in Jesus roles, casting white characters in all the, you know, Alexander the Great, for instance.
Yeah.
All of these characters, there's just been this long history of rendering white characters who were non-white, that there, you can see why there's an impetus to try to correct the scales.
Yes.
And I think we would agree that just tell us that that's what you're doing. You know, tell us that you're trying to correct a sin that previous generations have made.
Yeah, I feel like it would be for the discourse around things that if there was more of an openness, I think it would overall go down better. I mean, there's always going to be people who dislike it simply on a racist basis, but a lot of those who are, you know, like me, very attached to the text, just, you know, would prefer to see an honesty about why you make adaptation changes. And in some cases, it can be important for dispelling the notion that you feel like you're, the author did something wrong. For example, I've seen people critique the lack of black people in Westeros, but on the other hand, they don't respond very well then when you tell them that, well, this is a Europe that never had a slave trade.
Yeah, but it's not Europe at all. That's the point. I mean, if Martin wanted to include a place like Dorne, he could have done it, and I think he's talented enough of a storyteller to have done it with a sense of authenticity. It just so happens that wasn't really on his agenda in the mid-90s.
No, and would it be on his agenda? I mean, you envision a story a certain way from your, you know, from your experiences. And I mean, yes, you could have had a migration from the Summer Isles, for example.
Yeah, I think he could have done it. I think he easily could have. He's talented enough to force my disbelief out the window on so many issues. You know, I'm not just suspending disbelief. Like I'm in the world. Like,
yeah,
he's talented enough to do that. It's just that it wasn't on his radar to do that. And it very well could be that if he was writing in today's world, he is attuned to these kinds of conversations, that he would have written a different story. And I think that whenever you're going to adapt for the screen, the deity in the room is not the original text. The deity in the room is the story. And if you think that you need to change the text in service to the story, I feel like you have to make that decision. That the story is guides everything. If you can't tell the story you want to tell on the screen by being faithful to the text, I think that you have to change the text. That's my sense of it.
It was very interesting because I'd formulated some comments to have as a guideline before starting this. And I'm basically, you know, at the opposite, like, if you think you need to change the text beyond, you know, budget, what have you, all these things, don't adapt it. If you think there's something in this text that doesn't mesh with today and you can't present it as it was originally intended, don't adapt it.
There's so much of film that we would have lost. You know, we wouldn't have Shawshank Redemption. We're about to see both Foundation and Dune represented on the screen. I'm looking forward to it. If they don't change Foundation significantly, I will be disappointed. Because it's a story that absolutely needs to be updated.
We had a discussion about that, Elio and I, just recently. And when you're talking about science fiction, which tends to be more of looking from the point of now and forward, when the now point has changed, I see the argument a little bit more for science fiction. And I actually made some comments on Twitter a while back when we watched the adaptation of Brave New World. And I said that, you know,
interesting,
something along the lines of, you know, considering my comments on Game of Thrones, you know, it might seem odd that I will say that I liked Brave New World, because it deviates a lot from the text. On the other hand, I can see why this is a text that otherwise they would have said, we can't adapt it. It is too outdated as a vision of the future, and too outdated in the opinions and attitudes that it presents for the future. But then I was like, I think you should call it inspired by Brave New World. It is not an adaptation of Brave New World. It is a story inspired by Brave New World. Yeah, there is a blurry line there for sure. But it certainly tended more towards the inspired by Brave New World. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Linda, I'm so glad that we had this conversation. I mean, look, I just feel like this is the venue for these kinds of conversations. Yeah. I think I understand your position a little bit better, and I'm glad that we're able to do it in a way that, you know, we can be respectful and agree to disagree on many things, but also find some common ground here and there.
Absolutely, I'm appreciate that I had this opportunity, because you say this kind of is a very important topic. It needs to be carefully considered, and I certainly acknowledge that I cannot see the American perspective from the inside, and I can't see how it matters to see yourself represented. It's a very different experience than what you have growing up in Sweden in the 80s and 90s.
I appreciate you being willing to have a hard conversation with me and make it such an interesting and enjoyable experience. So thank you.
Yeah. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now Steve and I cover The Children. This is the season finale that features the departure of Tywin and Jojen. Bran, Mira, and Hodor make it to the Three-Eyed Raven. Dany has to lock up Drogon. Qyburn says that he can not only help the Mountain, but make him stronger. And we have the famous showdown between Brienne and the Hound. Without further ado, here is comic Steve Osborne. Steve, would you rather have your final moments of life upon a beautiful fjord like the Hound did? Or would you rather die on the toilet like Hound did?
I'd take the toilet.
I was gonna guess. All right, yeah, I think that a lot of people might think that that's an embarrassing way to go out, and I think maybe Tywin thinks that too. I think he, you know,
well, that's your legacy, right? What's the next song gonna be?
I mean, I've had some of my most profound alone moments in the privy.
Well, yeah, the thing is, it's really
a place of comfort for me, to be honest.
And if here's the thing, let's say I'm on the fjord, yeah, and I'm. Chances are I'm probably going to poop myself in the death process anyway.
Sure, yeah, might as well be on the toilet.
If I'm already on the toilet, that's to be expected. I mean, you're going into the bathroom, you're not going to be like, oh man, what a mess. And there's comfort. Die doing what you love, I guess.
Yeah, I think that for most people, they would prefer the fjord, but you and I might challenge that notion. Consider the privy. Consider the privy.
What if this is all I've got and there is no afterlife, or I saddled up to the wrong god or gods, all these different things going through your head, right? And you see this beautiful fjord. And to me on one hand, you're like, okay, it's the last thing I'm going to see on this earth. At least it's beautiful. But then there's this other sense of like, it could feel like a mockery. As you're fading, it's like, well, this is it. This could be it. Whereas on the toilet, there's something a little bit more profound in this idea of, look, man, I'm just the earth's waste.
Okay. Where should we start?
There's a lot, man. In fact, I think we were about 40 minutes in, and I go, this is the same episode where Stannis' army showed up in the north.
You know, it's funny. I was watching this last night, and I was about maybe a half an hour in, and I thought, I know what's coming next, but so far this is pretty dull. But it sure ends with a bang.
Sure do.
All right, let me ask you this. Was it a bigger gut punch to see the Hound go out or to see Tywin go out?
Probably Tywin. Just because, I mean, there's so much gravity and there's so much of the universe here. either it can't is about to be impacted by him, has already been impacted by him.
And all of these lesser satellites are just going to fall out of orbit.
Well, yeah. So like when he's gone, when he's out of the picture, there's this like, well, who can take the mantle of that level of influence, you know, just legend and strategy, all the things that go along with it, right? So it's like you get a sense of, well, now everything's up for grabs. And maybe that's part of the great twist.
Well, narratively speaking, it does have kind of the impact Ned's death did, because just as far as all of the different intersecting plots go, Cersei, right. Jaime, Tyrion, the Tyrells, you know, we're starting to see him, you know, Danny get on his radar.
Yeah.
There's just tons of stuff, you know, the Red Wedding he orchestrated and, you know, all that stuff. And now it's like a black hole in the narrative that it's going to be impossible to fill. And then, but in addition to sort of the narrative hole that leaves, there's also the sense of the political chaos,
right,
where King's Landing is just up for grabs right now,
right? Because nobody's like, oh well, Tommen's still there. You know, I mean, you get a sense that there was less danger to a certain degree with King's Landing, with him at the helm. People may be less apt to just go after the throne because of Tywin's presence and influence. So there's a lot of that that's just sort of, it feels very up for grabs. And and what you're going to find out is like how much he was relied upon without even knowing it. Like he just took care of stuff. Like just like the very notion that he seemed to be the only guy that really had a grasp of the fact that they're in debt. And there's a lot that goes along with that. And so he held a lot of information because we wanted that kind of control. And so now people don't even know what they don't know.
Well, that's right. And he was the one that knew that an alliance with the Tyrells was kind of important, even if you kind of had to hold your nose to do it.
Yeah.
Whereas if Cersei was in charge, there's no way that alliance would have happened, right?
Right.
Cersei is good at a lot of things. One of the things she's horrible at is making alliances.
Right.
Now, we have not talked about Jojen.
No.
Jojen dies too.
You don't.
Jojen kind of saw a vision of himself burning back in Craster's Keep, like his hand was burning.
Right.
And he was starting to talk a little weird. You know, he's talking about a guy whose days are numbered.
Right.
So maybe his death was a little bit less. Maybe that was part of it. Maybe we just didn't really care about him. I don't know.
Yeah, I kind of was always like, all right, I don't really know what to think of Jojen. I always felt like yeah, he feels important, but not to me. It's just a,
yeah. I was actually, to me, I was more impacted by the death of that man's little girl, and he brought in her little burned body, and like he's arranging her skull in such a way.
That was
like, I didn't know that girl at all. Exactly. I don't know her name, and I felt like that was more of a gut punch than Jojen.
For sure.
All right, so let me tell you about what happens in the books to Jojen.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a little bit speculative, all right? But he just kind of disappears. Like, he gets in the cave, so he's safe and sound inside of the cave. And then they just don't see him for a few days. And then Bran gets fed like this, some kind of psychedelic goo that kind of looks like veiny flesh. And so there's a theory running around that the Children of the Forest turned Jojen into paste. And so kind of his little magical, you know, green scene body got turned into a psychedelic goo to enhance Bran's abilities.
Okay.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, maybe that's a little dark, but I think that's a little bit more interesting than getting blown up by like a pine cone bomb.
Right. Yeah, man. Magic came in hard and fast in this one.
Yeah. We met the children.
And then, the, like, I don't know. sort of like Labyrinth or meets It or something going on.
Well, a little Pirates of the Caribbean too.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so.
There's something about a zombie that's just inherently more like, the more flesh a zombie has, the more it seems like a zombie.
Yeah.
If it's just a skeleton with a sword, I'm just, you know, you're like, Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah, or Evil Dead.
Sure.
Army of Darkness type stuff. But there's always something about, I don't know if you notice, like, zombies can be lumbering. Man, skeleton soldiers, they fast. I mean, they don't have any skin slowing them down.
Yeah, well, that's a little strange because they have the muscles.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I mean, I know it's all magic, right? But, but you would think.
Right.
But I guess you're right that a skeleton would probably be more aerodynamic.
Yeah, I suppose. It's a lot. That was a lot to take in. I mean, it was a great scene, but I'm like, wow, we're just here comes more magic, I guess. I mean, and like magic that I'm reconciling dragons, I'm reconciling the undead, I'm reconciling people coming back to life and scroll.
Oh, yeah, people coming back to life. So Qyburn is able to, I think he's going to be able to salvage the mountain.
Yeah. Which, again, added even more surprise when I see the Hound die. Because I'm like, okay, well, we're setting this up still. Like, there's still, you know, every time you think that there's going to be this moment between two characters, that one of them just dies. So, like, there's just no, it's fascinating how, and you still are so used to that as a trope.
Yeah, yeah.
That when it gets sort of circumvented, it still feels jarring. It's like, okay.
So, and then Cersei says, will it weaken him?
Right.
And Qyburn's got this great, he's like, oh no.
No, no, no. Yeah. Yeah.
So I think we're going to have a little Frankenstein's monster happening with.
Sure. Why wouldn't we?
Why? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right. So Dany locks up her dragons. I think that this is brilliant. I think it's like, as long as Dany's power is held in check, I'm going to be interested in her story. The more power she gets, the more it's going to seem like, oh, well, all she has to do is decide to go conquer everything.
Right.
No one's going to stop her. But I like the idea that, okay, these dragons are too small to attack, and now these dragons are too wild to control. Yeah. So I like...
One of them's just gone. I mean...
One of them's gone and, like, eaten kids.
Yeah.
So she locks him up.
So that's talk about a switch, right? I mean, like, we talk about this all the time. Like, you normally the seasons end with an increase of Dany's power.
That's right. Yeah, she's going to be on the rampage. She's going to get a superpower or something.
So this one is like she's being more burdened with the price of leadership.
Yeah, she's decided she wants to rule, and now she's learning what that looks like.
Yeah, her ability to just sort of just go for it, it's dwindling dramatically because she's seen the fruits of that firsthand. Like, so the idea of her being known as the mother of dragons, and every time they give her introduction, and there's just, you know, title after title after title, and she's always just so giddy to hear it. And now she's got to take the big one, the mother of dragons, and she's got to lock him up, And so then I'm like, well, wait, well, what now? I mean, it's not like she's just kenneling him. I mean, it feels like she's just putting him in a prison, so to speak.
Yeah, she doesn't really know what to do.
And first thought is, how does that help you tame him?
Yeah.
So it feels like taming him is now no longer a priority, just the possession of him. And I'm just like, to me, that feels like that could be a problem.
I think it's a big problem. I think it's a big problem because... the one thing she had going for her before was that she kind of could command them, right? Mm-hmm. And people could see her command them, and that added to her mystique.
Right.
But this is a problem for her, for sure. Cersei reveals to Tywin that she and Jaime are lovers.
Right.
And okay, so you could read this as he's kind of willfully turned a blind eye, and he didn't want to believe it, or he just couldn't believe it. What's your sense?
I think it's all of that. I mean, I think he's a if there's smoke, there's fire kind of guy. I don't believe that he thinks it's a fake news issue that was going around, right? Because if he knows anything about what got Ned in the situation he was in, it all had to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big concept. It's not just a rumor. It's the actions in which set off, you know, a war with Stannis Baratheon. It's because of that Winterfell is in the condition it's in. I mean, the whole thing is set off by that. So to just be completely dismissive of it as just a rumor doesn't seem in line with Tywin's nature. Now, to be sort of willfully ignorant, then everything you're fighting to protect is now a problem, because your son or your grandson does not have the rightful. You're not doing this right. You've acquired the throne on a lie, and you'd much rather, if you're Tywin, acquire it by conquering. How do you can you justify being sort of this greater good type leader if your entire defense is defending a lie?
I think I read this a little differently than maybe you do. I think he's so focused on legacy that he actually has neglected to see what's going on right under his nose.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his character is more interesting if he has that weakness. So I don't know. Maybe I kind of read it as if he just really had no idea, because he never really cared.
Mm.
And what was his strength ended up being his weakness in the end, right?
Interesting.
So that's how I read it anyway.
It's an interesting read. It makes him more, I think, a more complex character. It seemed, like I said, it would seem illogical to me that with all of his knowledge of everything going on in the kingdom, that he'd be like, yeah, I think I may have heard something about that. You know what I mean? It just doesn't. He's a man of contingencies, mm-hmm. and he's a man of research. It would seem surprising to me.
Sure. All right. So Tyrion becomes a murderer.
Mm-hmm.
And he murders his lover, and I forgot that he said sorry afterwards.
Yeah.
That sorry just really got me.
Yeah.
That's dark, man.
So, does that make sense to you? I feel like with Tywin out of the picture and Shay out of the picture, I'm just like, well, but really? I mean, how did she go there? How did she go from... We talked about how, like, it seemed that there was like kind of an understanding when he was mm-hmm. calling her all the things that, like, look, yeah. They're both truly in love. Everything about her character seemed to be genuinely concerned about Sansa, genuinely in love with Tyrion. And then we see the testimony, and it feels like, okay, there's got to be something else at play here, because this seems incongruous with where we left them off. So maybe there's a threat, or there's some other thing going on, and then to find her in Tywin's bed, I'm like, I'll be honest, I was just like, I don't know if I buy this. I mean, sure, it's a great plot device, but I just feel like that's what it was more than anything else.
Okay, let's talk about it. So, do you think she had a choice to be in his bed?
I don't know.
I mean, if Tywin says get in my bed, my sense of it is that she's being used. She was used in the trial, and he's continuing to use her. So she could be like, well, I can either play the game here, or I could wind up dead.
Yeah.
But then that doesn't explain why she picks up a knife.
Right.
I mean, she tries to stab Tyrion. Or I don't know what she's going to do with the knife. It seems like she's going to do Tyrion harm.
Yeah, she doesn't seem like she's just using it for self-defense. So,
and she doesn't scream. I don't know.
So I just, that bothered me, because it's a moment that took me out, because now I'm asking questions. I mean, it's a great moment in terms of, like, here we are again, Tywin ruining his, you know, love, and sets him sort of in motion to do what he does next. But I don't get the motivation that brought Shay into that bed. So that's where I was a little taken out. And I don't know if that's in the book, but I definitely, it you know, I had to suspend that and be like, all right, I guess.
Oh, yeah, this is in the book. And I, okay, so here's another way to look at it. I mean, one way to look at it is that Tywin is using her, right? The other way to look at it is that Tywin's using her. Plus, she kind of wants to get back at Tyrion, who has jilted her.
Mm-hmm.
And what better way to get back at Tyrion than going into the bed of the man he hates most in the world? Or the man he has the most complicated relationship in the world.
Yeah, but she doesn't know that he's going to find out. So isn't that the point? The point of doing something like that is because you want it to wound. And if this guy's sentenced to death, you may never get there.
Sure.
So these are the things that I don't, and from a Tywin perspective, I could see him just using her, but it all seems very specific and not consistent.
Okay, option three. Shay's a survivor, and she had a good thing going with Tyrion. She was the lover of the Hand of the King, and then Tyrion fell on hard times. And she could have tried to make that work, but then Tyrion tries to, like, ship her out of town. And she's thinking, well, he's out of the picture. I'm a survivor. This is how I survive. If the new Hand of the King is interested, then why not?
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, okay, here's the other thing about it that probably doesn't help. Because I don't quite get the motivation behind picking up the knife. Unless she thinks she's in danger. I don't know why she would think she was in danger from Tyrion. She ends up getting choked to death with the golden chain that Tyrion bought her.
Right.
Anyway.
No, I mean, it's all powerful. And I think without that, it's hard to get Tyrion to kill his father as opposed to just leaving, right? I mean, so I think that's an important catalyst. I guess I just would have liked a little more. It's just, you could even a little dialogue or, you know, something, like, even if she was just to say something along those lines of, like, I don't know. It just went right to it. And I mean, I understand his crime of passion kind of thing. But again, I was a fool for buying the relationship, but I never felt faulty.
Yeah. Okay. So Varys offers her a bunch of diamonds to leave. And she decides she's not going to take them because she's in love with Tyrion. I mean, that's how I'm reading the whole thing.
Right.
So how does that work? Maybe she was so much in love with Tyrion that when he kicks her out and says some really hurtful things to her, now she's the jilted lover, and now she, you know, she feels the same way Ygritte does, where it's kind of like, I hate him so much, now I could kill him.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. I guess. I mean, I'll have to allow it.
Okay, so here Tyrion kills Shay. I got the sense he didn't think he was going to find her, number one.
Right.
This was not premeditated. And I don't know what he thought was going to happen, but when she pulls out the knife and he starts fearing for his life, I mean, he may be pretty strong for a man of his stature, but she still has a bit of advantage on him.
Right.
All right. So I'm kind of winding up to the question here. Do you read this as murder or do you read this as self-defense?
Oh, murder.
Really?
It's a crime of passion.
If the roles were reversed and Tyrion's laying in bed and he pulls a knife on her and then she, to defend herself, chokes him to death.
If the circumstances are the same, where she has been sentenced to death because of his testimony of lying, and he's in bed with her mother, who has had a history of ruining her life with lovers, I think I'd be more inclined to think that it was murder, a crime of passion. He's a man condemned. He's a man that is trying to flee death by the hand, you know, by the order of his own father. In his father's bed is his ex-lover, who basically helped kind of seal the deal in terms of his his sentencing. And so there's, she's betrayed him, his father's betrayed him. I think he's got one thing, and he's like, you know what, I'm a dead man anyway. I'm gonna go down swinging. I'm not letting these people that screwed me over get out of this thing any better than I was. That's what I mean. And again, I don't know that it's, that's a lot of words to assume that that's how much was going on in his head, but I think it goes by pretty quickly.
Well, yeah, he's a pretty complex character, and so there's a lot that goes into something that's going to alter his character irreparably, because this changes the way him. It changes the way that he's going to see himself.
So what's his other option, right? So, like, let's say he sees her and then she doesn't pull out a knife. Are they going to talk it out? She could go warn Tywin. She could say, hey, he's leaving. I mean, what are you, without, unless she's still in love with him, she's kind of in the way of his escape.
Well, let's say she is still in love with him. What if he has the presence of mind to say, hey, you kept on saying, let's get on a ship and flee. Here's a chance. Here's our chance. But the knife comes out. I mean, that's the thing I can't reconcile.
Well, I don't think he's ever going to say that, because she's in the father's bed. I think that die was cast as soon as he saw that.
Yeah. Hmm.
I think there could be a natural inclination to not want to paint Tyrion as a murderer, because it challenges our ability to sympathize.
And yeah, that's right. I mean, it's really difficult, especially. Like, everything about the scene suggests that he's guilty, and he knows he's guilty.
Yeah, so the idea that, like, maybe you were saying that, you know, you prefer the reading of Tywin as someone who was so focused that he was ignorant to some important things around him, and that, you know, makes his character more rich. I would suggest the same thing, that the idea that the calculated, always thinking, kind of sympathetic, and maybe the one guy with empathy for Bran, empathy for the Starks, empathy for the people in Flea Bottom, all these different things, that he too has a breaking point. You know, the very same way that, you know, it's like, ah, you know, I'm starting to root for Jamie, I'm starting to root for Hound, and then they become who they are, and then so we go back to condemning them. This is almost a reversal, right? You know, now we're like, oh, well, gee, this certainly complicates Tyrion. Am I willing to then uncomplicate, like, if he does some more good things, am I able to go back the same way that I went back to the negative with the Hound and Jaime? So, I mean, I think that there's an interesting character arc that that gets upset by this, because now, you know, we want to latch onto somebody to root for, and now he's a murderer, so can you still root for him? And I think that's the challenge, and I think that's a necessary challenge.
Yeah, well said. Very well said. If you're going to rate the fights between the Viper and the Mountain and Brienne and the Hound, which of these fights would you rate higher?
I actually think the Brienne and the Hound one was pretty great.
I thought it was pretty great. I thought it was pretty great when they were just exchanging hockey punches to the face.
Yeah. Yeah, and there was something about it that maybe it was the directing, but compared to, like, the Viper and the Hound, because there was so much pageantry that went along with it too.
Yeah, that's right.
With the Viper and the Mountain. And whereas this was just like, I mean, and honestly, when you're in this kind of situation, you're like, from a story perspective, I have no idea who's going to win this thing.
And well, the Hound's a little bit slowed, right? The Hound is slowed down because he's got some sort of infection on his neck.
Yeah.
And there was kind of a buildup, like Arya said, look, you're walking a lot slower than you used to walk. You should have let me burn it. And Brienne, I mean, we know Brienne is a...
She can hold her own against Jaime.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I found it all very believable.
Yeah, no, it was a really good scene. And again, still kind of surprising, because to see the Hound go, and man, Arya does get to, I mean, that sequence where he's just basically trying to goad her into sticking a knife into the heart was just so miscalculated on his part.
Okay, let's talk about Arya. All right, so in addition to us I mean, can we still root for Tyrion? We have to ask that question about Arya too, because it's one thing to have her get revenge on Pollivar, who's a world-class asshole.
Right.
The Hound, we've started to like the Hound a little bit.
Right. And he's done some, you know.
And we just had that mercy killing episode where.
Yeah.
It's like, you know. Look, her philosophy is believable to me. Her philosophy is that, hey, I believe in death. And sometimes it's not the worst thing in the world, death.
Right.
You know, it's just you're just ending and slipping into nothingness. And sometimes it can be a mercy. This is kind of her looking into his eyes
as he's pleading with him,
as he's pleading and sort of enjoying his agony.
Yeah.
Just so can I, yeah. Can I root for Arya in the same way that I did before?
Well, I think Arya and, you know, and Heather was really keen to remind, you know, me of her age. And, I mean, if she's in a very short period of time at a very young age has witnessed and endured just a boatload of tragedy.
Yeah.
And to think that that's not going to have some sort of a lasting and negative impact on someone's worldview. It's the creation, right? We're actually getting like, so all these other people are just, we're just sort of thrust into their lives. The Hound is this killing machine. So is the Mountain. Jamie is, you know, sociopath, this, that, all this other stuff. We get a little bit of background through stories and this and that, but Arya, we're getting to watch transform real time. Mm-hmm. So we're getting to see, you know, whether she ends up like the Hound or whether she ends up like a Jamie type character down the road. We're getting an origin story to someone that we've probably seen already, but we just got thrust into their life sort of already in progress. So when all the times we've talked about trying to create a certain sympathy for Jamie, but it just seems to be elusive. Well, if we had seen him at this age endure what she endured, maybe you do feel it, because you're just like, well, this guy had no choice. You know, he never had an opportunity to do otherwise. And that's the thing with Arya, is that you just see that, like, so it's you're getting to watch tragedy unfold. And so I think you can still root for her is a different story, right? Because we may get to a point where we don't have the option to root for her anymore. We just feel for her. And I think that so depending on how her narrative shapes out, if she ends up a Hound-like figure, it will be harder. And I think it will be almost impossible to see any death as like satisfying. Because instead, it's like just one more step into decay.
Yeah, this is Michael Corleone in the sense that he's just, you just can't take your eyes off him. He's just so interesting. And you're seeing him kind of spiral into depravity, just become the monster that his father was, you know, becoming more and more of an anti-hero, but still really compelling to watch, right?
Yeah.
And I think Arya's kind of along these same lines where she's just super compelling to watch, but it's like every step she takes, she's becoming more and more of an anti-hero.
Yeah.
And, you know, further to the point, Heather's point, she's a kid, you know?
Yeah. And so the question is how long before there's no redemption, or have we already hit that spot? So that's the thing, is her character goes from someone you're like, I hope things work out, to like, I don't know, man. I keep watching this spiral. This could be rough.
Dismemberment count. I do believe that Brienne bites off a piece.
Oh, yeah.
Of the Hound's ear.
Yes. Yes.
She goes full Mike Tyson.
Yep.
With his Evander Holyfield. And I like that she fights dirty, because she's, you know, you'd think that she's, you know, sort of this pristine, noble knight. But
right.
She can get down in the dirt.
And it was an important thing for her character, too, because now we're like, okay, so she's not just a Oberyn.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah, okay, so that's good. That's good. All right, let's talk about the Brienne-o-meter.
Pretty high.
Pretty high on Brienne. All right,
yeah. Good.
And you got to think she's going to try to chase Arya at this point.
Yeah, I would assume so.
And she, what else is she living for at this point?
Well, yeah, exactly.
I mean, until she realizes what she's got in Pod, there's really no other.
Exactly. And that's, man, purpose. talk about a hidden gem there. Well, you think he'd mention it at some point.
Varys, I feel like the trial scene makes more sense now because I think he's putting on a show.
Yeah.
During the trial. So he would not be suspected as an ally, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, like he knew what he was going to do to some extent. That gives me hope. You know, I don't like losing the Tywin character, but if I get some Varys and Tyrion in the future, I'm okay with that.
So with Tywin gone, it seems like King's Landing, the power brokers at King's Landing are Cersei and Margaery.
Yeah.
And Varys, I suppose. I think he can still wreak some havoc, but just as far as who's got their hooks into Tommen, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because I mean it helps Cersei with Tywin gone, because I mean Tywin's all about like, no, your focus is gonna be on your sham marriage that's gonna happen.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's no way she's getting married now, right?
No, and that's the thing, right? So he basically said, look, you're not gonna have any time. So it's Margaery and Tywin, tug of war on Tommen, and now Cersei is gonna, I mean, I just the Tyrells seem like don't get cozy, Tyrells.
I would imagine that Margaery has a leg up here, because Tommen is a boy of a certain age where biology just rules every synapse in your brain.
Yeah, that's fair.
And Margaery's pretty good at playing that game.
Yeah. And playing it with a certain innocence for him too. Like she really, when she went to visit him in his room, I mean, she was PG seductive.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, we never talked about that scene in depth, but I found it really creepy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
She's just using every bit of his, you know, budding teenage sexuality against him.
Yeah.
It's just gross. Gross, yeah. Gross, gross. So I think Marjorie's, I mean, I think she, if we're going to do a power ranking, I think she's got to go up in the power ranking, because Tommen's at that age where he starts to resent his parents,
mm-hmm.
start to want to distance himself specifically from his mother.
Right.
And, you know, as a lot of teenage boys do. And then, of course, you know, he just now budding, you know, awakening.
Right.
And Margaery is there to feed the beast. I still would place Dany at the top of the power rankings. What do you think?
I agree. I think, I mean, Wild Dragons still feels like it's something. Tame Dragons are great. Wild Dragons are probably okay.
In the books, Dany's got this big problem with dragons, and that's where her story kind of ends, in that she really doesn't know how to control these dragons. And there's this side narrative about this fancy magic horn that will bend a dragon's will to whoever has the horn.
Huh.
So there was a lot of fan speculation about this at this point in the season, because Sam finds, in addition to finding all that obsidian,
mm-hmm.
he finds this horn along with it. And there's this question about, did he find the magic horn or whatever?
Interesting.
So anyway, it's a big deal in the books, and that's kind of where her story's at this point. She hasn't figured out how to tame her dragons yet.
Mm.
Some would argue, Steve, is that you've seen the best that Game of Thrones has to offer, because the end of this season kind of goes downhill.
Okay.
So, I mean, some fans would say, look, you're going to see flashes of brilliance over the next few seasons, but you've seen the peak. You've seen the pinnacle of Game of Thrones.
Is there satisfying things that happen in terms of what happens?
Yeah. In fact, I think I would place season six pretty high on my pretty high on my list.
Okay.
In fact, I might even say season six is better than season four. And I know that Oh, that's period. Big. A number of people. So, but you're gonna have to slog through season five first.
Okay. All right. I mean, just season five is just
not to build you up.
Just from the entire season is just from the point of view of a box that Tyrion is in.
You could just skip ahead. That'd actually be pretty great. If I just gave you like a 5-minute synopsis of season five and we skipped right into season six.
That's perfect.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon season two, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I want to talk a little bit more about my conversation with Linda. In a previous Bird's Eye View, I made it very clear about my feelings about ethnic representation in Hollywood, and I think that I try to communicate some of that to Linda. But I think that there are some listeners that might have wished that I didn't have her on at all. I have to tell you that I don't come at this as a social media activist. I don't spend a lot of time on social media anymore because I found it depressing. I am an activist at times. I will march at times for things I believe in, and I donate money to causes that I believe in. At my core, I'm an academic. And as an academic, I'm interested in the dialogue. I'm curious. I want to hear what someone else with a different point of view thinks. And I'm committed to finding the best arguments in the other. And I'm interested in finding what's weakest about my own arguments. And I'm interested to see where that conversation goes, to see if there's something that fruitful comes out of the tension. In other words, I don't need conversation partners that have my same views, even on ethical matters. That's not how academia works. So because I come at these conversations like an academic, I'm of course going to be open to hear views that I don't agree with. And it doesn't mean that I need to persuade the other person. It doesn't mean that I need to be persuaded by the other person. Sometimes the conversation is worth having simply to keep lines of conversation open. If we can't have conversations about low stakes topics like Game of Thrones, how are we going to learn how to have conversations about things that are of more import? And that is all for this week.